Welcome everyone to session on gambling. I've been going to these meetings for a long time, in fact so long I can't remember when I first started going, but it was in the early 70s. As John Thorne has pointed out, baseball's origins were closely tied to gambling to promote its popularity. This was typically an American, of all American sports, but baseball was well behind horse racing, boxing, and even crew when it came to betting and the fixing of games. What I'm going to do first is make some comments about baseball and gambling before the 1930s, some things which you may have had some familiarity with, but which may have missed your eyes because nobody wrote about it. Baseball and betting had a long bad reputation because of a history of fixes. In the 1870s, there was considerable gambling or auction pools on baseball. Henry Chadwick, the father of baseball, wrote back in 1872, if the game seems would soon disappear, it would be after it has died because of pool selling. Let me make some points about early gambling and fixes. Back some years ago, Daniel Ginsberg wrote a book where he talked about fixes going on in the National Association in 1874 and involved a gambler from Chicago named Mike McDonald. McDonald not only was involved in fixing the 1874 game in the National Association, he also fixed the game in 1877 before the famous one at the end of the year. This involved the Mutuals and the Chicago White Stockings. Now, this is very important for American history because Mike McDonald, you may not know, was the first head of organized crime in the United States. And this was an example of him getting his involvement in gambling. He was the number one operator of gambling operations in Chicago. He owned a store called The Big Store downtown. He was involved with all the gambling that was going on. And he was able to do this because he was also one of the major figures in Chicago politics. Gambling in the early 20th century, I'm having trouble reading my stuff here, is a sport where a lot of American sportsmen were involved, especially owners of baseball teams. Frank Farrell, who owned the New York Yankees before Rupert, Stoneham of Chicago, who owned the Giants, the president of the National League, who's also the owner of the Cincinnati Red Stockings, Red Blakes, was also very involved. So this is something that was not new. What was also not new was gambling on big events. And the biggest event in baseball was the World Series. And we don't know too much about early baseball gambling in baseball because nobody seems to know that it was going on, but in fact it was. In 1911, for example, a Philadelphia pool operator sold thousands of tickets, gambling tickets, to the World Series in 1911. In 1912, there were thousands of tickets sold, gambling tickets sold, for the following World Series. Now, we would think that with the coming of the World Series being fixed in 1919, this might be something that would end, but it was hardly the case. By the way, Arnold Rothstein's associates, when it came to gambling, were people like George M. Cohen and a band named Nick the Greek. Nick the Greek got his financial support from Arnold Rothstein, and in 1925, he was very involved in gambling in the World Series between the Pirates and the Washington Senators. In fact, he is said to have made $250,000 on this. In the World Series of 1925, Frank Mencke reports, Frank Mencke, very, very famous sports journalist, that $2 million was bet on the World Series back in 1925. And again, since this is just after the World Series being fixed, you might be surprised that this was all going on. Another aspect of early baseball gambling that hasn't gotten much attention, which I'm just going to mention in passing, was gambling I want to call parlays. Parlays were a gambling situation where you bought a ticket, you got a list of two teams on it, and your job was to pick the tickets with provided the most wins and runs, rather, or least runs, and gambled on it. And this was very, very popular among the working class in the United States. Now, give me an idea of what was going on in gambling. Let me show you this table here. Oops, I'm backwards. No, we went ahead of ourselves. We only got a couple of pictures, we can't get them straight. Pretty bad. Where's picture number two? I'm missing picture number two. Oh, there it is. I don't get it on my screen. Okay. If you can read this, God, it's big enough, I think. You get an idea of what was going on in gambling in 1935, in the middle of the Depression. In the Depression, there was an enormous amount of gambling going on. Why was it going on? Well, people needed money, and this was a fast way to make money. People also were looking for a good time, and this provided good time until they lost the money. And what you will see here is that gambling is heavily dominated by horse racing, which is the sport I'm most interested in, anyhow. And what you don't see is the term baseball mentioned anywhere, because baseball was not getting much attention as a gambling activity. In fact, it actually was subsumed under the category of a lottery. The gambling in baseball that was going on oftentimes, as I said, was involving the betting people did on games, which teams were scoring the most runs, which were scoring the least runs. And in 1929, 1930, 1931, thousands and thousands of dollars was being bet on this form of baseball betting, which nobody knows about. In fact, in 1929, the U.S. government went after these guys. It was a big business coming out of Albany. And in fact, in 1929, the U.S. government claimed that $35 million was spent on baseball gambling with these people. And this gambling, at that time, what they did was they would mail out the tickets that people bought. And the government says, this is bad. Not only is it bad, it is illegal. In 1895, a law was passed to prohibit the mailing of lotteries, which were no longer legal in the United States. Today, every state has it. The gambling on baseball was considered a lottery because you did not show your expertise in saying, well, I want to pick the Cardinals. They're going to score a lot of runs. Because the lottery, when it came out to you, it came to you with the name of teams. You had no expertise required. It could say the Yankees. It could say the Browns. Well, the government went after them, and they won their case. And so this enterprise, and through this business in Albany, went down out of business. They were particularly active in Massachusetts, which in those days had no horse racing. But in the 1930s, they would add horse racing, and Massachusetts was one of the most successful states with horse race betting. Now, does become a bigger factor in gambling, but not in baseball gambling, was a form of sport gambling called the point spread, which I'm sure almost every one of you are familiar with. And this became very popular in team sports that had high scoring, like basketball and football. And what bookmakers realized was that a lot of the games that were going on, no one wanted to bet on, because they figured that UCLA was going to clobber East Jesus State, you know, by 1,000,000 points, so no one would bet on them. So some wise guy came up with the idea of saying, let's add points to the inferior team. So if the game is going to be, let's say, 70 to 50, let's give them, say, 17 points. And so now it is a close game, a competitive game, and it becomes very exciting. And point spread is still a major factor in American sport gambling today. This didn't work with baseball. Very little of a point spread, and even today not too much, is used with baseball. In baseball, the point spread was only 1.5 runs because the game is like 7-5, 6-4, not a big spread. This did not help the baseball gambling business much at all. But what did help the gambling business was the return of the parlay. The parlay was extremely popular in working class neighborhoods. Thousands of people who worked in factories were gambling on the parlay. You'd get the ticket on Monday or Tuesday. On Saturday, there would be a payoff. You might spend as little as 10 cents. And the odds of scoring $8 might be pretty strong, 80 to 1. Chances are you weren't going to win. Now, most of the people who were doing this parlay were not looking for $8. They were looking for the big prize. The big prize could be like $2,000. 10 cents, you win $2,000, fantastic. Problem was, almost nobody ever won. Part of the reason was the games you were given to pick were always very competitive. They didn't play the Browns against the Yankees. They would play, say, the Giants against the Cardinals, where it was very, very hard to pick. What made it more difficult was these were games, this betting was going on, was sponsored by the gangsters. And when it came to the gangsters, they didn't like to lose. And one of the ways they made sure they didn't lose, especially the big prize, is they often didn't pay off. So you would get involved in this, and it became a game that thousands of people would be playing every week. And thousands of them would always lose. But it was very popular for betting on baseball. It didn't require any special knowledge. And in fact, compared to other sports like boxing or horse racing, betting on baseball did not require a lot of specialized knowledge. Most people knew a lot about baseball, enough to make a bet. Now, when it came to World War II, there was a big increase in gambling on baseball. As we heard a little bit before from Geisler talking about life in America in the 40s, it was very dull, dreary. People liked to gamble for fun. Baseball was also seen as a game where you gamble for fun, not to make a lot of money. And it was exciting. And one of the ways we know that gambling was going up was through the writings of one of Ring Lardner's son, Ring Lardner, the famous sports writer of the teens and 20s. And he went to a Westchester gambling hall, and to his surprise, the main thing they were betting on was not horse racing, they were betting on baseball. And he was sitting there and listening, and all the calls that came in, they were all on baseball. He said, "A gambling epidemic on your hand is what you see here in baseball, when the big betting parlors are doing business almost solely in baseball bets." Now, one guy who got into this business was a guy named Bob Martin. And if you're an avid gambler, you would know his name. In the 60s and 70s, he was the big bookmaker, the odds maker in Las Vegas. When he was a child, he grew up in Brooklyn. His parents had a deli. And he used to visit the deli, and he'd see these men always talking about baseball this and baseball that and gambling and betting and stuff like that. So he got into it. And in fact, when he went to Thomas Jefferson High School in Brooklyn, that's what he did for his leisure time. He made book. He sold bets to the students. And after he went to college, he went off to war, fighting in France. This is what he does in his free time. He sees all the guys in the unit, they're listening to the World Series. Everyone's got their eye on the World Series. So he says, "Listen, I know about baseball. I'm going to make bets with them." And when he finishes the war, he comes home with $30,000. So he says, "I think this is a career for me." He comes back, and a friend says, "Why don't you go to the Polo Grounds? There are a lot of people betting there. They'll bet on anything. They'll bet on pitches, a ball or strike. They'll bet on the score. Bet a ball is going to be caught." He says, "Great idea." And he goes there, and to his dismay, he finds out they know as much as he does. So he decides he's going to try something else, and he goes to Washington, and there he bets on boxing and football. And he ends up making a very big success for himself. Now, shortly after the war, very little has been written about baseball gambling. When it is written, it's usually about fixes of games. And since there weren't too many games being fixed, sporting news has almost nothing about gambling in baseball in the 30s and the 40s. Neither do the daily newspapers. But in the summer of 1949, two publications do get involved in this. And one which didn't exist very long was called The Baseball World. Baseball World was a magazine that lasted for about 4 months in 1949. It was a nice magazine, good pictures, well edited, and very smart. And in its last issue, in 1949, it published a big article about gambling on baseball in the United States. It reported, after an interview with someone from the U.S. government, that there were a lot of money being spent on baseball. It was estimated $12 million a week was being gambled on baseball in 1949. Three-fourths of this was done with bookmakers, 20% with the the betting on parlays, and 5% pardon me, 5% on parlays and 20% on gambling on cards, the parlay courts. That's what I said. Well, the magazine ran out of business, and basically nobody read it. But about the same time, a newspaper in New York, named the New York Post, which many of you may have grown up with, as I did, sent two of their reporters out across the country. They interviewed lots of journalists, and they did research, and they discovered, yes, there's lots of gambling going on in baseball. They came up with slightly different numbers. They said it was probably 12 to 23 million, 33 million, which was, I think, a big exaggeration. But the point was, they found a lot. And they found that it had a big impact on American life. The leading gamblers who were involved in this big boom in baseball gambling were some of the biggest gangsters in the United States. Names which may be familiar to some of you. Ralph Capone, brother of Al Capone. Jake Guzik, who was Al Capone's number one buddy. Frank Erickson, the number one point spread man, number one guy dealing with payoffs to betting, as well as others. And they were pretty rough about this enterprise in baseball. They were not above calling up baseball players and warning them not to try too hard on a given day, urging them to pitch not so hard on a particular day. And these were the guys who were running the biggest gambling operations on baseball. In fact, the Capone mob, which still existed in Chicago, controlled what is called the Racing Wire, which sent information on racing all over the United States to people who paid for it. Of the money being spent on gambling in the 1940s, about 50% of it was gambled on horse racing. But 25% was on baseball. And the authors, the journals I've been talking about, the baseball, the Sports World and New York Post, they claimed that baseball had caught up to horse racing by 1949. In other words, they argued that baseball had about $6 billion a year spent on gambling, equal to horse racing, which by this table, there's not even any competition. Now, one of the things this article, these articles found out from the New York Post, was that gambling was not limited to adults. They discovered that, lo and behold, lots of children were gambling. Some of them were learning, like Mr. Martin, from going to the restaurants, going to their father's businesses, that gambling was okay. Not so bad, not such a bad thing. Well, they interviewed the reporters, and they found out that people are gambling in college, gambling in high school, they're gambling in junior high school. These are boys primarily. Now, what did they do? Well, sometimes they gambled in the cafeteria. Cafeteria at lunchtime was a good place to make book. Oftentimes, these were kids who were working for an adult bookmaker who would assign them to go get kids to pay, take bets, maybe a dime, maybe a quarter, maybe even a dollar. In school, they didn't like it. Teachers didn't like it. Teachers tried to stop it. Principals tried to stop it. Sometimes they did. So what the kids would do is they say, I'll meet you next hour after school. We'll meet at the local, they didn't have pizza yet, at the local hamburger joint, the hamburger or the hot dog joint, and they would do bets there. They found kids as young as 11 years old were gambling on baseball. Now, one kid who gambled on baseball at this time was named Sol Gittleman, who later became a very famous professor at Tufts University. And he learned about gambling from a wise old man he knew. It was his father. His father was a professional bookmaker. The Gittleman boys and their mother lived behind the candy store where the father sold book. He had like 15 telephones doing business. And Sol learned a lot about gambling by going through the front door of the candy shop, because that's where all the gambling was going on. So he was interested in gambling, and he was interested in baseball. And he also learned from his role models. One of his pals ran what was called a six-hit pool. In a six-hit pool, you had to select three teams, and if they got six hits between them, six of the players they picked got hits between them, you could win. He would charge a nickel, a quarter, and offer odds of 3-1. In New Jersey, where this boy came from, they would always pick New York Yankees or Giants or Dodgers, never pick guys like Ted Williams, and so they lost most of the time. And so by the end of the school year, Sol's friend had made a lot of money. Well, Sol says, what am I going to do this summer? I got nothing to do. I'm going to sell odds on the baseball games between the Cardinals and the Red Sox. And most of his friends are all going to root for the Red Sox because they won 104 games. They have Ted Williams. Well, Sol is no slouch. And he knows, for example, that Ted Williams hurt himself in a practice game after the season. He also knew that the Red Sox were not really strong enough with right-handed batting, and Cardinals were using lefties. They were in trouble. And he took odds. He won the World Series when Cardinals won, and he made $25. He got a list of who to ask to join him in his betting from his friend who had been selling odds all school year long, and so he gave him $5 in return for his help. This was the last time Sol Gittleman ever bet. Now, last point about gambling in mid-century. A study was made in 1950 by a journalist, and this is what he found. He was named Murray Schumach. He was with the New York Times, had a very, very big reputation. And what he discovered, as you can read here, was that there was about $15 billion being bet on baseball in 1950. The major money, baseball and racing, each $6 billion. So if anyone thinks there wasn't much gambling on baseball going on, well, it doesn't. That's not the case. Now, a few years later, another study was made which sort of confirms but somewhat detracts from this study. This was a study of gambling by the underworld in upstate New York. And what they found in this study was that baseball was still doing very well. It was down, however, to 30%, horse racing 42%, other sports taking the remainder. And what I think this points out is that I don't think baseball ever caught up to horse racing. I don't believe baseball ever caught up to horse racing, but baseball was doing pretty darn good as a gambling activity. Let me conclude with the point of this all. This paper argues that there was a remarkable increase in baseball gambling from the middle of the Depression to the post-World War II years. This reflected the enormous popularity in America of gambling, in which we can contribute to the great decline in people viewing baseball as a sinful activity. Gambling is no longer considered sinful. Bookmakers are no longer considered bad guys. They're guys who help you have a good time. And also, it's because baseball is getting more popular, as we heard from Geitscher before, although in the late 40s it does decline. The big gain in baseball gambling does not mean that the sport was surpassing thoroughbred racing, which it did not. Thoroughbred racing actually was drawing more people since 1940. In fact, from 1940 to the mid-1970s, more people went to horse racing than went to Major League Baseball. In fact, by the late 60s, more people went to horse racing, thoroughbred racing, and harness racing, than to all baseball, major league and minor league combined. Nevertheless, baseball was still, you know, the national pastime. Betting on baseball was made more popular because the baseball was becoming more popular. It was becoming something many Americans had done overseas, like those who had bet with Mr. Martin in the war. And also, we have use of telephones for information on baseball. And because children had learned that gambling was not the worst thing in the world, and it was something that prepared them for gambling as they grew up. Thank you very much. Yes.
I'm wondering, boxing was really popular at that time, so boxing must have gotten a lot of attention. Also, do you know if there was any betting on the Negro League games, or in fact, even any betting on the female leagues? We heard about both of those in earlier sessions. So I'm wondering if there was any betting, do you know about betting on other than Major League Baseball, Negro Leagues, or in the women's leagues?
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite follow. It's too loud.
I'm asking if you knew about whether there was betting on in the Negro League games, and also about any betting even on the women's baseball league.
I can tell you, there's no research done on either subject. I can also tell you, I'm sure everyone was gambling on everything. For example, 1949 in America, there were gambling on who was winning the title in the American League and the National League. So gambling was ubiquitous.
Thank you for your talk, but I was curious, when you were doing some of your research, what kind of historical sources did you use to find some of these numbers and kind of pull it out? Was it just newspaper stuff? And I ask that because obviously gambling back in the day was much more of an organized crime thing than it is these days when you can just go on the FanDuel site and pull financials.
You know, so, something wrong with my ears.
What kind of sources?
Actually?
Can you use microphone?
Oh, yeah, you can't hear me. I can.
The coming of the computer and companies like ProQuest has made it a lot more possible to study things that were impossible to study. Magazines that we never heard of have become possible to gain. Some are not. Sports World exists in two places in the United States, in the Library of Congress and the University of Notre Dame. There are no copies of it anywhere else. Other things, like the New York, when even the New York Post is not very accessible on the internet, but when it was printed in 49, other newspapers in other towns, some of which you never heard of, I never heard of, are reprinting what they have. So that's become a very, very, very good way to do this kind of research, which I'd done research on baseball and gambling in the 1970s. This kind of stuff was impossible to get. I took for granted, like everybody else did, that all the baseball gambling was inside the ballparks. And without this, it's impossible.
Thank you.
Yeah. I guess that's it. Thank you very much.